Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, well, that's not cool. Good evening. It's Radio Free Kansas. We had a caller there and he jumped off. That's not cool. That was Django Reinhardt, Gypsy, resistance music from Hitler, Germany, occupied Paris. You're on the air, 636.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy is right. How are you doing? That's something else.
Yeah, some good music there, man. It's Django the Great Gypsy, man.
Yeah,
I remember that. He was a gypsy. People didn't remember that, during the Holocaust, the German Reich there killed about 500,000 gypsies, which is a large percentage of the gypsy population.
He was playing right under their nose in Gay Paris.
Yep.
How you doing? How's our friend? What's the latest on our friend from the G20?
Oh,
the Twitter.
Friends are actually doing okay. They're doing okay. They got some good representation, and can't say much, but things are doing good, I think. We're selling the holy roller bus. We're selling it for legal fees for them. We're going to send them off a nice mutual aid gift as soon as the bus sells. So.
Oh, hell. Really? Line 2, 310, you're on air. You're on air.
Hi.
Hi.
It's Melissa Roddy.
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good. Is this Michael?
Yes. Yes.
It's Melissa Roddy.
Hi. Oh, hi. Oh, my goodness.
Time.
I was thinking we'd do this. Well, Melissa, let's talk. Tell us about your documentary you're producing.
Well, it's called Conflict of Interest, Patterns in Chaos, and it's actually still in production, but Afghanistan is so much on the front burner right now, I figured I'd better come out and tell people what I'm working on rather than, you know, stay in the closet till I'm done, because I really care about it. I care about the decisions that are made with regard to Afghanistan. So, and what I've done is I've really pulled back. I've done some, you know, deep research at the library to a large degree. Because you'd be surprised how many, you know, actual documents are available to us publicly. And then I've gone around and I've talked to firsthand participants, people who, from the State Department and the CIA and journalists and, you know, people like that, members of the Afghan community. I seem to be talking to the Afghan community more than anybody else. So that's what it's about, kind of.
Hi, when do you think when do you think it'll be out?
Well, hopefully, you know, like the full-length version will be ready in about 6 months, I'm hoping.
Where can people
Melissa,
get a...
Can I ask you a question, Melissa?
Yeah, please do.
What do you think about Barack Obama winning the Nobel Peace Prize while he's bombing Afghani citizens?
Well, that's a misperception. He's not bombing Afghan citizens. The people who are bombing Afghan citizens are from Pakistan. Pakistan has a long border with Afghanistan that was drawn up. It was just drawn on a map back in 1893 by Sir Mortimer Durand, back when it was Afghanistan and British India. And it divided Pashtun people, and the people who live along the border never recognized it. What?
Film documentary is on right now. I got to pay attention for a while.
Michael's talking in the background.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the thing is that Pakistan was created out of four different ethnic regions, and it's dominated by the Punjabis, which is the region in the northeast of Pakistan. And the people who live in the west of Pakistan never wanted to be part of Pakistan. And they are related to people on the other side of the border in Afghanistan, and the people who run Pakistan are afraid if they don't keep Afghanistan unstable, then Pakistan will fall apart.
Okay,
right.
We have U.S. and NATO forces, though, are being charged with war crimes in Afghanistan, within Afghanistan, and Obama's sending in more troops on a weekly basis.
Now, who's being charged with war crimes?
U.S. forces and NATO forces, both, by the Afghani civilians. The number of civilians killed in Afghan is up 40% from last year. And
yes, but it's not because of it. But it's because of suicide bombings. Suicide missions are up because the U.S. and NATO troops are being more effective at shooting at the Taliban as they come across the border. You have to understand the Taliban is not a Pashtun movement. It is a Pakistani paramilitary force. And so its job is to do two things, suppress the Pashtun nationalists in Pakistan and keep Afghanistan unstable.
So the 828 people killed last year in Afghanistan were all killed, they were all either Taliban members or they were killed by suicide bombers? They weren't killed, none of them were killed by U.S. forces?
No, I wouldn't say that. And I'm sure that quite a few of them got caught in the crossfire, and I also believe that some of that crossfire was caused by false flag missions. I guess that's the way you call it, what you call them. You know, the Taliban will actually call in an airstrike. That the U.S. and NATO get tricked into thinking that the Taliban is using they're using the civilians, not as shields, but to embarrass the U.S. and NATO, to make you think that we need to get out of there. Do you understand? Because
yes,
Pakistan
I do.
Making...
Sure, I understand that we do need to get out of there.
No, but we don't. If we get out of there, let me say something very, very important. Between 1992 and 2001, up to 1.5 million Afghans were killed. if we leave before Afghanistan is strong enough to defend itself, which it's not at this point, given this management by the Bush administration, if we leave before they're strong enough to defend themselves, we will see a repeat of those kinds of numbers. So the hundreds that are upsetting you now will become hundreds of thousands.
Well, I think the Taliban, you might be right, ultimately the insurgents, the Taliban, are using the civilians, but honestly, the military forces, the NATO, the most recent atrocity was where they somebody, maybe the armed forces, called it Taliban, stole the gasoline or fuel trucks and then took them.
Yeah,
and
Let me finish.
Then a bunch of civilians and maybe some of the insurgents were busy stealing the fuel off the fuel tanks, and NATO, actually German called in United States airstrikes, blew up the fuel trucks and incinerated over 100 people, many who there was undoubtedly, I think 40 were children, and many were civilians. So maybe it's the insurgents. I'm not even sure anymore what the Taliban is. Even General McChrystal is saying that there is some Taliban that should be part of the government, and there are some that shouldn't. This sounds a lot like the situation. An old guy like me, I can remember the same situation shaping up in a place called Vietnam, where they couldn't separate the insurgents from the people. And I don't know. About staying in Afghanistan.
There is a very clear enemy here. Now, there are members of the Taliban who are people who have been disaffected because their families have been caught in the crossfire.
Uh-huh.
And there are also members of the Taliban who are in it just because they're getting a regular paycheck there. The Taliban, when the Taliban first came on the scene in 1994, they were organized by Pakistani intelligence. And this Robin Hood fairy tale about Mullah Omar and his band of Mary Madrasa students who cleaned up Kandahar, it's just a complete fabrication. What really happened was General Nasrullah Babar, who was a member of the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence, and who at that time was Minister of the Interior for Benazir Bhutto, got a bright idea on how they could continue to bomb Kabul while opening up trade with Turkmenistan. Turkmenistan is on the opposite side of Afghanistan from Pakistan. So they didn't want to stop bombing Kabul, and they had this guy, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, doing that for them, and they wanted to keep it up. So how were they going to get their trucks across Afghanistan if they didn't stop bombing Kabul? Well, General Babar had this great idea that they could go across the south from Kandahar to Herat and on into Turkmenistan. So they took these boys that they had been training in these madrasas along the border in Pakistan. They started out as refugee kids. Now, you know, these families come pouring across the border during the 80s, and they have nothing. And there are recruitment centers set up where they say, give us your son, and we will feed, clothe, and educate him for free. Or if you're a penniless refugee, you're going to say, well, thank you. But those boys were isolated from their families and raised in a completely different, separate from Pashtun values. They were raised with Saudi Wahhabi Islamic values, which is very different from Afghan Islam. Afghan Islam is much more moderate than Saudi. Anyway, so these boys were indoctrinated in Wahhabi Islam. They were given training in Quran and Kalashnikov. Pretty much that was it. So because who knew how long the Soviets were going to be there? They were going to be the next wave of fighters to fight the Soviets. So General Babar looks at this large population of trained fighters and says, why don't we send those boys in to clean up that highway? We'll straighten that place out ourselves from this along the southern route from Kandahar to Herat. So they load thousands of these boys onto buses, give them brand new weapons, put Pakistani officers in charge of them, pay them three times the going rate for an Afghan militia member. They have planes, they have tanks, they have heavy artillery support. When they have their first battle in Afghanistan, they were supported with heavy artillery fire from across the border in Pakistan. So that's who the Taliban really is. It's not some Pashtun movement. It is a Pakistani paramilitary force. So, and their job is to destabilize Afghanistan, to keep it too weak to assert renegotiation of the border. That's what it's all about. But if we
we're talking now. Tell us who you are and where, and your site, so people can listen and contact you later. Tell us who you are and your site and how to contact you. Go ahead.
Well, my name's Melissa Roddy, and I'm working on a film called Conflict of Interest. And you can look at clips of it at afghan-info.blogspot.com, or you can search Conflict of Interest, Patterns in Chaos on YouTube, and it's in three parts on YouTube. Conflict of Interest, Patterns in Chaos. And the reason that it's called Conflict of Interest is not just because this is a conflict we're all interested in, but because certain American leaders, policymakers back in the 80s, had financial interests in Pakistani oil wells back then. So when Charlie Wilson was going around saying that he was, helping the Afghans, Afghan freedom fighters, what he was really doing was allowing Pakistan to continue to destabilize Afghanistan. And that's what And this ongoing destabilization, this ongoing effort by Pakistan to use fundamentalist rebels to keep Afghanistan unstable, was a situation that Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, he saw that situation in 1979 and said, you know, if we pour a little fuel on that fire, I bet we can get the Russians to invade.
Right. And this would, listeners, by the way, line 3, area code 740, you're online. And line 4, 785 are online. And there's still one more line open. If you'd like to call in, feel free to call in to Radio Free Kansas at area code 646-716-8652. And let's try to be courteous to Melissa and try to talk one at a time.
Michael,
try not to use your speakerphone, listeners. Speak directly into the phone one at a time. 740, area code 740. Line number 3, and line 4 is 785. One at a time. Do not use your speakerphones. Go ahead.
USB card. That helps.
Do you have a question?
I'm on line 3. I don't know who you're addressing. Like, do you want me to go?
Do you have a question?
Let's see, Rod.
You did go down there now.
You don't lose it. Now put it right back in.
I'm really confused.
I'm just going to wait till you say the area code again before I talk.
740, area code 740, do you have a question for Melissa Roddy?
Yes.
Film documentary. Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, this is Tony in Ohio. It's nice to talk with you guys. I'll try to make it brief because it seems like you have a lot of people online. She brought up Zbigniew Brzezinski, and that's what I was going to bring up. I wanted to know... she knows a lot about the area and about the conflict and about the involvement of Pakistan and especially the development of Taliban and the difference between the Taliban and the Pashtuns, and I'm with her on all that. My only question is, since we were heavily involved through the Carter administration with Brzezinski and even after the fact, as you said, into the 80s with other interests besides the more direct interest of drawing in Russia into a quagmire, or the Soviet Union, I should say. What what involvement do we still have via the CIA? Because we were funding the ISI to do a lot of this stuff, and I wonder, you know, how much of that has trickled off, or is there still money going into that? And if so, like, is that a, obviously the title of your film, Conflict of Interest, that would seem to me to be an ultimate conflict of interest.
Well, yeah, it is. It's interesting that you should ask that because, okay, there are three forces that we are fighting in Afghanistan. The Taliban is only one of them. Al-Qaeda, we all know about that too. But the third force that we're fighting is called Hezbi Islami Hekmatyar, also known as Hezbi Islami Gulbuddin, H-I-G, HIG. And Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, the leader of that group, was the Mujahideen party leader in the 1970s and 80s, because he actually started with Pakistan. He signed up with Pakistan back in, like, 1972. He was the guy... Hold on just a second. He was the guy getting the most funding and weapons during the 1980s and into the early 1990s. And what I was told last year by a former intelligence officer is that Gulbuddin Hekmatyar is still on the CIA payroll. Now, that's a conflict of interest as far as I can see. Basically,
yeah,
we're doing two things that don't make sense. We continue to fund Pakistan, and the money we give Pakistan goes right into the pockets of the Taliban, and we're continuing to fund Hekmatyar. And both of those factions are fighting our soldiers. So our soldiers are facing bullets we paid for.
So am I to understand that the Mujahideen is actually, like, split into several groups then?
Well, it used to be. Seven groups, and that was a strategy by Pakistan, you know, a divide-and-conquer strategy.
Right.
And this worked very well for them. There was never a single Afghan resistance force. There were seven. So there were, and they were encouraged, or Hekmatyar was encouraging his troops to fight against their allies.
Hmm.
So there are, I have State Department cables from, like, 1981 showing that inside Afghanistan, factions, Mujahideen groups from other factions would come across Hekmatyar's soldiers, Mujahideen, and the Hekmatyar's guys would start shooting at them.
Wow. I really appreciate your answer, and I won't take up any more of the show's time. I know you guys got a lot of people online. Thanks a lot. And it just seems to me it's a huge mess, and I'm from the anti-war right. I'm on, like, the other side of a lot of politics. But on this, it's like, I just, what a mess. And I just wish we could find a good way out of this. So thanks a lot, guys.
The good way out of this is to help Afghanistan rebuild. Once they are strong enough to defend themselves, like I said, this problem's not going to go away for them. But they have to be strong enough to defend themselves for us to leave honorably.
Well, I appreciate your time and your answers, and you seem pretty honest, and you seem to know more about it than I do, which I thought I was a nerd about it. So thanks a lot, and I'll be watching your movie.
You sound pretty well informed. Thank you for your question.
Yeah, you're welcome to stay on, too, with any other questions you have. I have an issue. I just, as you know, finished doing a show with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald in their book Invisible History. And they had a very interesting suggestion at the end of their book. They talked about diplomatic civilian on the ground, face to face, aid. Billions and billions of dollars have been wasted. Wouldn't it be much better to have some sort of massive Peace Corps type effort into that country rather than trying to police it and make their army stronger and their police stronger? Don't you think that would be, in my book, from the anti-war left position, wouldn't it be better to engage in that kind of stuff rather than possibly a surge or an escalation in troops? Do you really believe that the military of any form from any country can actually help these people in any way?
Well, yes, actually, I do believe that. Now, you have to understand, I come from a liberal background myself. I got involved in Afghanistan because I was so horrified by the stories I was hearing, you know, during the 1990s, the things that the Taliban were doing to people, and it wasn't just things they were doing to women. They were conducting massacres around the countryside. I mean, they would just roll into town, line people up, and start shooting. And I was horrified by that, and so I wanted to do something to help. And gradually I got more deeper and deeper and deeper into the subject to where I came to understand why it was happening better. And the answer is that their problem with Pakistan is not going to go away unless the Punjabis in Pakistan decide to leave the Pashtuns and the Balochis alone. If the Punjabis give greater autonomy to the provinces in the west of Pakistan and leave Afghanistan alone, then what you're saying can work. But for now, that's not the case. And there is a massacre going on in Pakistan against the Pashtun civilians. And it is not what people think. What is really happening on the ground is that the Pakistani military is working with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban to suppress Pashtun nationalism in Pakistan. Did you get that?
Yeah, I got that.
They're doing the same thing in Afghanistan, basically. They're just not uniform. They're not wearing Pakistani uniforms in Afghanistan. So if we send a lot of Peace Corps people in there, it is not. They're just going to get killed. Now we need to send them in, and we have lots of State Department people that are going in right now. People, we have provincial reconstruction teams that are going in. Now under Bush, they were severely underfunded, and they were underprotected. So you have to have both. The humanitarian mission has to have a defense component, or they'll just get killed. That's why Doctors Without Borders left, because their people were getting killed.
Well, they got more. It was more savage. I'm not sure when Doctors Without Borders, when did they leave? When was that?
I think it was like 2004.
When?
I think it was about 2004.
Right.
Now, they might have gone back since then, but...
That's as the savagery of the occupation of the U.S. invasion.
They were killed by Taliban. They had
They were killed by the insurgents, whoever they were.
It's a mistake to call them insurgents. It's a misnomer. They're invaders. They're not insurgents, because insurgents makes it sound like they're a native force, when they're not. They're coming from the other side of the border.
Actually, a lot of the Taliban are native forces. A lot of the recruiting done by the Taliban, specifically after the year 2000, when the Taliban declared... put out the first time ever in Afghanistan a decree against the growing of opium, of poppy, which is the major export for Afghani farmers. They started recruiting a lot of local Afghanis to fight against the Afghanis in the north who were growing opium, and a lot of the money, in fact, most of the money from U.S. funding went to fund militias of opium farmers to fight against the Taliban on their own.
Now, a lot of
this is about the opium trade, so let's not forget that either.
You have to understand something about that. The year before, they'd had a bumper crop. That was a market ploy. They weren't trying to get rid of opium in the economy.
No, they were trying to boost the price.
They were trying to boost the price, right.
Absolutely, and we couldn't have that because we are their main buyer.
And I think that's why the CIA is working with ISI, G.I. Joe out of there, because they want to work the opium trade uninterfered with.
Oh,
they don't
absolutely.
Want to support G.I. Joe. So, but to suggest that the Taliban is anti-opium is very wrong. I mean, they are making lots of money off of opium now.
They said themselves that they're not anti-opium because Afghani Muslims don't use opiates. They're anti-hashish, absolutely. They've been known to slaughter hashish farmers and people who traffic hashish, but when it comes to opium, with a wink and a smile, they gladly grow it and grew it up until 2000 when a lot of these wars began in 2001, a lot of the airstrikes, leading back to 96 with Clinton's airstrikes against the Taliban.
Clinton's airstrikes were just against Al-Qaeda training training facilities. And they didn't even strike bin Laden's, you know, home compound. But, yeah, the Taliban, found a little clever way of saying, well, you know what, we're growing it for non-Muslims. Muslims can't take it, but we can grow it and sell it to other people.
Right.
Which I've seen on television that I was watching, I think it was, I don't want to say what station, but they had a half-hour show about the heroin problem in Afghanistan. So people do have an opium problem. It's not that they're not doing it. Is it maybe a key strategy that we should be, instead of, because I know at first we thought burning the fields was this great idea until we realized that they actually do that every year just to make them regrow anyway. It's just kind of part of the process of growing opium. After we figured that out, I mean, maybe the key strategy here is to allow the people of Afghanistan to control their opium fields and use that to fund this idea that you have to maybe, you know, have a secure force before we leave, you know, because it seems like, you know, it's a money pit when we're allowing the control of the opium fields to be half for people that we like and for half for the Taliban. I mean, they just use it to fund themselves, so why not control the opium fields and release it over to the people, let them do what they want with it?
Well, I mean, I think we need to give them incentives to grow something other than opium. We need to help them convert their crops.
Yeah, but we're talking about agriculture built around.
Isn't that colonialism at its greatest?
Well, no,
isn't that the definition of colonialism?
Straight up. This is straight up imperialism. I have a problem with the whole notion that the people of Afghanistan, I mean, I've read the disturbing book by Gould and Fitzgerald, Invisible History, The Untold Story of Afghanistan, published by City Lights, listeners. And I have a problem with this. This sounds strikingly familiar with, as I said earlier, with the strategy of Vietnam, where we have
the Golden
Triangle.
It's the Golden Triangle, absolutely.
It's a mess, and I'm not sure continued military U.S. military presence in there. Well, you know, my beef with the anti-war let me finish. My beef with the anti-war forces, I can't even say that. My beef with the Republicans and the right-wingers in this country, in the United States, is that basically their main strategy is to withdraw from Afghanistan and not shut down any other military-occupied countries like Okinawa and Japan and the other
Asian. Arguing for that. I agree with you.
I think we should shut down all the bases.
Yes,
all
amen.
The foreign military bases and bring all the troops home and let the people fight it out. Now, I know, Melissa, you feel like we have a moral obligation, but I'm feeling awfully bad about the situation as it is now, and I'm sure this country, the United States, is going to go through 10, 20, 30 years of what was called back then the Vietnam syndrome, and hallowed be thy name. You know, like now it will be the Afghanistan-Iraq syndrome. The 8 years of the dark years of the Bush administration and their neocon strategy for world domination has bankrupted this country. The United States is never going to get back off its knees and even protect its own borders. We'll protect our own borders or act as a sovereign country ourselves.
Well, Michael, neocons and neolibs have very, very little to fight about. They're both absolutely in line with the global capitalist. I hate to use the word, but it's a global capitalist conspiracy. I mean, it's
imperialism.
It's 100% imperialism.
Well, I would disagree. I think if the mission in Afghanistan had actually been imperial, Bush would have committed more resources to it and not diverted everything to Iraq. As it is, he committed a cosmetic number of forces and a cosmetic amount of reconstruction aid. In fact, he didn't even put it in the 2003 budget. Congress had to add it back in.
I kind of agree with her because, you know, in a way, if you look at it, it's kind of like when he was told about the memo about, you know, bin Laden determined to attack in the U.S., he, like, put it on off to the side and said, well, let's keep talking about this plan to invade Iraq. And this is way before 9/11. And then,
right.
you, you know, it's no surprise that as soon as he kicked in the door, so to speak, in Afghanistan, he immediately said, all right, let's go down to the neighbor's house in Iraq and kick their door in, because now's the perfect time. We've started a war. Nobody's going to ask any questions why we're invading another country. Everybody's still pissed off because we got attacked. You know what I mean? And I hate to say it, but
this goes along perfectly
like,
with that explanation of neolibs and neocons working together, because as soon as the Democrat gets into office, his campaign promises weren't anti-war. They were to pull the troops out of Iraq and to invest troops into Afghanistan, invest troops into Pakistan.
This is
a colonial war. In fact, when you say things like we should give them incentives to grow other crops, number one, that is colonialism, to come in and retrain the people in a way that fashions your ideas is a colonial idea.
It's not colonial to help people grow food.
Well,
they want to grow food. They can't afford it right now. First of all, opium doesn't require any water, and during the Soviet years, their irrigation systems were destroyed.
I mean, if the word free market, if through a free market system you can get these people to grow something other than opium, that's great. But if you have to like subsidize something to unlevel the price field just to get them to grow something else, then it is colonialism, because who are we to say that, you know, it's a world free market. If people want opium, they want opium, and they're going to get it somewhere. And if they're not going to grow it in Afghanistan, they're going to grow it somewhere else. And if it so happens to be that history's proven that's the cheapest place to grow it and the best place to buy it from, then who are we to stop it? And no law in the world stops anybody from doing anything they want to their own body. So,
well, I'll tell you, Tony, as soon as somebody else starts growing opium on a large scale, we'll have a U.S. imperialist war there too.
Right, yeah, no doubt.
So, I mean, you know, to safeguard their own countries, Mexico's opium production went up greatly during the Clinton administration because of the ties on the hands of the exporters from Afghanistan. Mexico started producing opium at a rate greater than they've ever produced in history, and that has subsequently died down since 2002 because of our realignment with the opium growers of Afghanistan.
Good point.
Okay. I don't have anything to say about Mexico, so that's not my field. I mean, I think that I think it's really, frankly, arrogant to suggest that people don't want to grow food to feed their families and that it's colonialism to help them do that. Of course people want to grow food to feed their families and their communities. But they live in a devastated economy, and opium is just something that grows easily there. And also, they're being forced to grow it a lot of times because the Bush administration forced these drug lord warlords into the Karzai administration. They forced Karzai to accept people like Abdul Rasul Sayyaf into his administration. And so these guys have a lot of power in the country now. And they are the ones that are profiting the most off of the opium trade. And so people who want to convert their fields to pomegranates and grapes and the crops that they used to grow, apricots, they used to grow all kinds of things in Afghanistan. Olive. Yeah. And,
well, you know,
and
it's the same thing. It's the same thing with Kansas farmers. Will you drive, if you drive through the state of Kansas and you talk to any farmer who grows corn, he'll ashamedly say that he grows corn that's biomass that's not made for human consumption. Because and Michael Cadell can attest to this, that that farmers have been strong-armed by the state all over the world. This is no shock, and that is a form of imperialism. No matter which way we turn this key, until we take down the powers that control global capitalist trade, until those powers are brought to their knees, then we are going to have an imperialist war. Period.
And we have to get away from the idea that just because it's evil. You know what I mean? I said we have to get away from the idea too that if because somebody grows a drug, it's evil. Like that might be their best export. I mean, like Bolivia makes good coke. There's nothing we can do about it. You know what I mean? People want coke. They're gonna buy coke. Law be damned. So it's just a fact that you're never gonna get rid of that. You know what I mean?
Well,
maybe a large degree, you're right, that maybe there are people forced into it. But I'm sure that it's a very wealthy, lucrative trade, and some people are going to want to be in it, and we shouldn't be forcing them to convert just for the sake of morality.
I think Melissa would agree, though, that if the warlords were taken down, and they're not going to be taken down with an imperialist war by other warlords, this is just going to be a changing of the guards. But if the warlords across the board were taken down, that people would cease to profit from growing only opium, and they would return to a local-based food economy in all situations. I hope she would agree with that. Melissa, what do you say?
Well, I say it's a really complicated thing to take those warlords down now. I don't have the answer for that. The problems with the last election in Afghanistan, the corruption in the system that was obvious, is because those guys want to stay in power. And I'm not sure what we can do at this point to get rid of them, to help foster more honest people in government. I mean, I know that we are doing things on the local level to foster development of the bureaucracies, the local bureaucracies, so that people can trust their local sheriff, their local commerce department, power and water, whatever, their local bureaucracies. We're doing things on the local level, and the State Department and the Army are working very closely with local leaders, tribal leaders and such, to help them build their bureaucratic infrastructure. But as far as getting those drug lords out of the high offices in Kabul, I don't know the answer on how to do that.
Well, we'd have to get them out of the high offices in the U.S. as well.
Well, I don't know that we have drug lords in high office in the U.S.
We absolutely do. Look at the cocaine industry that boomed during the Reagan administration. I mean, this is common knowledge that cocaine was brought into this country and money was supplied to cocaine farmers. Aid, military aid, was supplied to cocaine distributors in Colombia by Reagan's administration. Why would it be any different when we see the Taliban receiving such high amount of funding during the Clinton administration, during the Bush early years of the first year of the Bush administration? So much money was sent to the Taliban to keep these drugs flowing, and now we have this imperialist war there now, and the opium trade is booming.
You're confusing the Mujahideen factions with the Taliban. They're two different things. They have the same mission to a large degree.
No, the Taliban farmers were also members of the Taliban who moved in the mid to late 90s into Afghanistan, were also funded heavily by the CIA. So I'm not really confusing the Mujahideen and the Taliban.
Okay, so you're talking about the 1990s. As long as we're clear, I understand. I haven't heard about that. My understanding is that they get their funding directly from the Pakistani government.
Through the ISI?
In the 1990s, we stopped funding. We stopped giving money to the ISI. Now,
No, the CIA and the ISI are still hand in hand.
The Bush administration certainly facilitated that, but I don't think that the Clinton administration did. Now, I could be wrong, and I'm trying to get back in touch with a contact that I've made, someone who knows about that stuff, who has connections to the CIA, but I don't have good, solid information on it, so I'm not willing to make statements about it.
Well,
my
career isn't on the line, so I'll make those statements. I'll make them for you, Melissa.
I do know they were doing it in the 70s and the 80s. But I also know that the Obama administration is not the Reagan administration, and that's kind of part of the problem.
Could have fooled me.
Well, it's
why would you say that's kind of the part of the problem? That we need Reagan too.
The problem.
What?
I was interested to hear that too.
It's the problem for them, because what I've uncovered is that Charlie Wilson specifically, and quite likely James Baker. I have fire on Wilson. I have smoke around James Baker at this point. But these people were the Pakistani purchased influence with them, so that they would let Pakistan control the fight against the Soviets. They had interest in oil wells in Pakistan. There was a company called Union Texas Petroleum, which was in 1997 purchased by ARCO, which is a subsidiary now of British Petroleum. Actually, it already was in 1997. And coincidentally, just as that they were, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's on that sale, all of Union Texas auditors, their entire auditing department, was assassinated in Karachi.
Huh.
And it was portrayed in the news media as a terrorist attack. But the group that was, you know, it was like 2 years later, they said, oh, we found the guys that did that. It was some group that nobody had ever heard from before. Nobody ever heard from again. They had no mission and no message, which doesn't sound like any terrorist group I've ever heard of. Al-Qaeda has a mission and a message. You know, they commit their acts because they have a mission. So a group that doesn't have a mission, a message, and is never heard from before, after this one attack in which a car is chased through traffic, pulled over, and shot into from three sides that contains four accountants, I don't believe the story, right? I think there was something else going on that Union Texas and the Pakistani government wanted hidden. Now, I don't know for sure what that was, and I'm not willing to make statements about it yet until I have the facts. But my guess is that there was a connection between those oil fields and the Taliban. Now, one of the reasons that I connect those oil fields to the Taliban, one slight little red flag bit of evidence I have, is that when the Taliban took over in Kandahar in 1994, they converted all of the fuel in the city. The city had been getting its fuel from Iran. They converted it all to Pakistani diesel. All the fuel stations in Kandahar suddenly were getting their fuel from Pakistan. And Pakistan doesn't have enough fuel to export.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember reading some of that, and myself being sort of mystified by or confused about that.
Well,
let
me go back, because there is something I left out, something very significant. I interviewed Joanne Herring, and she told me how she recruited the Pope.
Excuse me, who is Joanne Herring?
Joanne Herring is the widow of Robert R. Herring, who was head of Houston Natural Gas. In 1978, the Zulfikar Ali Bhutto administration, Benazir Bhutto's father, his government approached Robert Herring to be honorary consul for Pakistan in the United States. He turned them down and said, why don't you take Joanne, my wife? So Joanne says to me, they hemmed and they hawed and they gulped mentally, and they thought to themselves, what can we do? We don't want to offend this man because we hope that he might drill for oil in our country. So they accepted her. Now, the minute I sat down with her, the first thing out of her mouth was, we turned to Charlie because he was an old friend of the oil business. She met Charlie Wilson, who, after her husband died, became her boyfriend. Now, in January of 1981, before, like a week or so before the Reagan inauguration, Robert Herring gets his wife a meeting with George H.W. Bush. He's just about to be sworn in as vice president. She tells me the meeting is supposed to last for 15 minutes, but it goes for 2 hours, and he was very polite and didn't say anything. So for 2 hours, George Bush said nothing, which I can only, what was she doing in there for 2 hours, that kept him so attentive?
Video games.
I'm just
off the top of my head, the last time I sat with a person for 2 hours and not said a word, we were playing Super Tecmo Bowl.
Oh, no.
In 1981, that consisted of Pong.
Well, we need to give them, maybe that's what we should have bombed them with, was video games instead of cluster bombs. But I'll tell you straight up, I still haven't got back. You know, I still can't get over this thing that we're going to have to take the bitter medicine of the Vietnam syndrome. We're going to have to take the bitter medicine of the global war on terror. The global war on terror.
we have to stop defining it by Vietnam. It's an outdated paradigm. There's no more Soviet Union fueling the situation. In Vietnam, we were basically fighting a Soviet-fueled civil war.
I'm speaking from the people in Kansas, the people I visit with, my neighbors.
Yeah.
And we aren't the smartest, the sharpest crayon in the box. Okay.
Well,
but,
you're no different than people in Los Angeles.
People are really getting fed up, and I'm not going to tell them, oh, you need to. We're burying two young men, 23 years old, from Kansas this week in Kansas, that died in Afghanistan. Two.
Yeah.
And there's 127 dead out of Fort Riley. That's in Manhattan, Kansas, Melissa. And people are getting fed up with 8 years of this nonstop stupid war. I'm beginning to think. Now, let me finish. Let me finish. We can bring in all this intrigue and CIA, ISI, all this ruling class intrigue you want. But in my opinion, you know, what happened to the UN and what was wrong with NATO or the United Nations? Peacekeeping forces and the NGOs. I mean, we're going to have to handle it.
Here's
the problem, Melissa. You're saying we need to not only stay there with the military, but it's a slippery slope to another Lyndon Baines Johnson. You know, now I'm an old man, and you say, well, this isn't the Vietnam, this isn't the communist boogeyman. No, we have the Islamo-fascist. That's what the right wing in this country calls them. The Islamo-fascists have, despite Glenn Beck's best effort of trying to make me as a left-wing guy feel, you know, this country, the United States, is in serious trouble. And I'm beginning to think that we need to let the United Nations do the work that it was supposed to do. And instead of $5 billion a month to Afghanistan alone, maybe we should be pouring $15 billion a month into the United Nations and have them help out. I mean,
We would have to change the rules.
We changed the rules when we started, not me, the CIA and Reagan, started pouring military aid to these goddamn fundamentalists. These religious fundamentalists.
That was a bad idea. That was a terrible idea.
Well,
and the Afghans
were morally obligated to pay for Reagan's mistakes. I was very young at that time.
The Afghan people are paying for it. The civilians are paying for the mistakes.
Well, no amount. Look.
Let me address something you said about the UN, because it's a very important point. The only way that sending in UN soldiers would work is if the rules of engagement for UN soldiers changed. Right now, they can only shoot at somebody who's directly shooting at them, which turned out to be a disaster in Bosnia, because the Serbs would just shoot at the civilians and skip the UN troops. They didn't care about the UN troops. They wanted to get rid of the civilians. They were ethnic cleansing, which is what the Pakistanis are doing. They're ethnic cleansing those regions. There is a genocide going on against the Pashtun people. And I cannot stand by and say, oh, isolationism, America doesn't have any obligation, any duty to defend those people. I care about those civilians. And they are under a direct...
What about these young men in America who are being backdoor drafted into this goddamn military machine called the United States imperialism? You feel bad about the poor people in Afghanistan. What about the poor people in America who are going out and serving this as cannon fodder for this machine? I mean, why should we condone any of it?
Everybody that's in the military all joined up after 9/11, first of all. Now, if there are people in there who feel that they were recruited under false pretenses, that's a different issue. If those people say, I was recruited under false pretenses and I want out, then I think that a mechanism should be set up to let those people out honorably.
And can I say something real quick? You said the word isolationist, and I want to say something because I think it's important. Isolationism has a three criteria, and it's not the same as non-interventionism as a foreign policy. There are two different types of foreign policy, and the differences are clear because non-interventionism just means you don't attack people that haven't attacked you first, whereas isolationism includes protectionism in your tariff systems and taxes, and also an aggressive anti-immigration policy. So without those three criteria, we are not isolationists just because we want to be non-interventionists and not go around the world being friggin' Santa Claus and saving everybody who's under tyranny.
But wait, I
want to tell you something, 740. You don't sound like a skin-deep right-wing libertarian to me.
Tony's an anarchist. He just doesn't
sound like someone who knows his individual rights.
Tony, this is Rabble Rouser, by the way, from Burn.
You've done your work, and that's good for you. Thank you. That's right. And I don't think isolationism is a dirty word.
Wait. Can I say something, though?
Let's make sure that Melissa gets her two bits, and I'm going to bow out. I got a half a dozen guests in the garage, and I'm listening in. And if it gets too quiet, Melissa, I'll put on the Django Reinhardt again.
I'll let y'all plug it out.
No, you talk to these two brothers here, and I'll be right back. All right,
Tony.
Let me explain something to y'all. What happened under the Bush administration? Because everybody's feeling a great degree of frustration with the length of time that this has been going on, and I guarantee you, the Taliban is aware of that. And they have used that strategically. In fact, they post what they call night letters around in villages that say, you know, the U.S. and NATO, the West, won't be here for very long. They're going to go away, and we're still going to be here. So you better do what we say, people, or you're going to suffer mightily. But let's go back to the Bush administration, because it's really, really important to understand. The Bush administration looked like they were working for Pakistan all along. In 2001, when special forces had the enemy surrounded, Taliban and al-Qaeda leadership, they had them surrounded in the city of Kunduz, they were ordered to stand down while Pakistan airlifted the al-Qaeda and Taliban leadership out of Kunduz.
Surely.
I mean, what were we there for if we weren't there to round those people up?
I don't want to view Obama as being some kind of exception to these rules.
These rules of engagement have been
played by every administration when it comes to imperialist wars, and Obama is not showing himself to be any different. And It's only been 9 months, but I guarantee give it time, and it will play out the exact same. I guarantee you it will. Because these regimes are only interested in one thing, and Obama is not an exception to this. They are only interested in gaining capital interest from whichever group they can use to be in control, whether that group is a murderous regime or a democratically elected regime, which doesn't happen very often. The democratically elected regimes last too long when the American foreign policy is involved, because democratically elected regimes tend to be people who are self-powered and self-determined, and we don't like that. Because that's against our business interests.
Wait, let me finish. If that was the case, why didn't the Bush administration take advantage of it?
Because there's a lot. It's the same reason that Bush 1 didn't take advantage of taking down Iraq when he did, because he knew he could economically bleed them for the next 10 years with sanctions that wasn't going to affect the billionaires who were the leaders of Iraq. It was going to weaken the people of Iraq, and it's going to make them starve and beg for anything that can come their way that'll be any different. And it's no different with that policy
Afghanistan was already in that condition. Afghanistan was already a devastated population, ripe to be a cheap labor.
But the only reason that we wanted to get in there when we did was to open up more trade possibilities. And let's not forget how much money was made by Bush's friends off of the war machine, even on what you call the
superficial war. They made that money off of Iraq. They didn't make that money off of Afghanistan.
They made it off of both because they established, because what they did was they established in Afghanistan a position that when Iraq was finished, they could go right into Afghanistan and have a constant pipeline of money. There's no way they could have jumped from Iraq to Afghanistan, and there's no way they could have done what they did in Iraq if they.
Why couldn't they do it from Afghanistan in the first place?
Because that's not economically feasible to a war machine.
Let me ask you guys a question real quick because I want
One thing. I'm back online for a minute, only to open up line four. Melissa, you're popular tonight. Melissa, Roddy, give us your contact information again in line four, area code 210. You're on the air. Melissa, Roddy, welcome, and let's be nice to Melissa, Roddy. Melissa, give us more contact information again, please.
Please visit my blog at www.afghan-info.blogspot.com or look up my my shorts on YouTube, Conflict of Interest-Patterns in Chaos, Parts 1, 2, and 3, and write to me on YouTube.
Go ahead. Go ahead, gentlemen. I'm going to go back to the garage for just a second. Line 4, area code 210, you're on the air. Feel free to ask Melissa Roddy, the film documentary, and any questions you'd like. Go ahead. Line 4, are you on the air?
This is the Boogeyman. How are you doing?
Hey,
hi.
Right, brother.
Hey, Boogie.
Ask Melissa a question and go on with the discussion, folks.
Yeah, sure. You got a great one going here. I was listening. I kind of agree with both of you's point. The war in Iraq and Afghanistan for at least a long time were about money, plain and simple money. How much Halliburton could bring into the point? That's my belief.
Well,
other things too, but majority. But also, I agree with you. I think you said okay. Like the people right there in Afghanistan, Pakistan. If we leave, okay, let's say get out of Dodge or Ryder, I think even the plan where they do selective stuff, those people would probably be, like, you know, murdered. You know, Taliban's would come on down just we left Vietnam, okay, I think there are a lot of people just slaughtered, okay. The same thing will happen here, put money on, okay. I also think a lot of these reasons wars went on for quite a while. Well, wars are prosperous for millionaires. They make money. And the longer war lasts, the more money it's going to make. It's just a plain fact, no matter who's in power.
Also, Obama,
I don't think Obama's any different than the rest of them. Just look what he's done so far. I mean, he's going to put more troops in. I think we should go with the general's advice because he's kind of like an expert in Syria. You know, he's been there. Obama put in for his advice. He may not put what he wanted to hear. It's kind of like college, okay? If you're going to have brain surgery, right, you're a neurologist, right? If you're going to have a soldier, Michael, orthopedic guy, they're both experts. But you don't want orthopedic guy up and on your brain. You want a neurologist on your shoulder. Because, that, in other words, they're good at it, okay, but you want the right specialist for the right thing. And I think this general is what he's talking about. He has a lot of experience in that area. Now, will Obama listen? You're getting as good as mine, but I agree with both of you to a point.
Well, Obama's under a lot of pressure to not listen, but I'm trying to support him to listen to General McChrystal because General McChrystal's right. Too few soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan, and it needs to be foot soldiers. The air war is a disaster. That's a terrible thing for the civilians. So, but you have to have enough soldiers on the ground to keep the Taliban out of away from the civilians so that they can rebuild their economy.
I agree with that. You're so right.
It makes it a more dangerous situation. What was I thinking of? There was something you said earlier. What was the first thing you said again?
Me?
Yeah. Before you said
that, I think if we were to leave or even do Biden plan selective,
the people
in Afghanistan, the people like the civilians, they'd probably be slaughtered by the Taliban and what's the other one, Al Qaeda, because they don't care. I mean, they want over control of them. We'd probably see a mass slaughter, and that'd be into them. Then we lose credibility.
Okay.
We have to. It's a two part thing, I think. You got to win the people's hearts too, to the point, you know, and also and build stability also. And
I think it's important to distinguish between Afghanistan and Iraq. In Iraq, we were spending $15 billion a month. We didn't spend that much money in Afghanistan in 6 years. So to suggest that there was a lot of profiteering going on in Afghanistan, I mean, it's just not true.
Well, it might not be the same for both. I'm sure Iraq made tons more money. I have no doubt in my mind, okay?
I mean,
without question. There's more conflict on there. But still, it's just a slight little bit of money made off the war machine in Afghanistan, Pakistan.
Yeah.
Let me ask that question I was going to ask, because I'd like to get everybody's take on that. Since the economy is like, you know, 70 or more percent consumption now, and we really don't have, you know, all our productive industries have fallen apart as far as, you know, manufacturing, you know, car industries, whatever. Since we have no production industries left except seemingly the military-industrial complex, is the military-industrial complex actually too big to fail at this point? Is it perpetuation of an imperialism actually a means to an end at this point to keep a global collapse from happening?
Well, we have high-tech industries.
A lot of good that does when people don't have money to spend.
The military-industrial complex does make use of that, and they do get money from the government. You know, the tech industries do get money from the government. I don't think that the weapons manufacturers are too big to fail, if that's what you're suggesting.
Well, I mean, like, bringing the soldiers home as well. You'd have to have all these extra laid-off workers, you know what I mean?
Here's something actually very interesting that I just learned about day before yesterday. There was a meeting recently, a subcommittee hearing. It was subcommittee for oversight and subcommittee defense, the House Defense subcommittee for special forces, okay? It was about funding for special forces. And it was a Democratic committee man who told me about this, that he witnessed this hearing where the admiral came in and he wasn't asking for more money. And not only that, but none of the representatives who were conducting the hearing were trying to get more money for pork projects in their districts. What he was saying was, we're in a whole new era with regard to military. It's not an imperialist era. It's an era where we have small wars going on around the world, and we all want to help these people. We want to send in humanitarian missions, but the humanitarians are too much at risk if we don't send military in to protect them and to protect the civilians they're trying to help. And a perfect example of how deep this new trend goes is to look at Switzerland. Now, everybody knows that Switzerland is the classic neutral country. They never send soldiers in anywhere, right?
Right.
Well, Switzerland has a mandatory draft. But you don't have to do your service. You have to do 2 years service, but you don't have to do it in the military. You can do it with humanitarian organizations. But what they found was that the casualties among the humanitarians were, of course, much higher than the casualties in the military, because, of course, the military was all staying home in Switzerland. So there was a vote they had a referendum in Switzerland to embed soldiers with humanitarian missions that they send out around the world. And the Swiss people approved this referendum, because that's really the new paradigm. That's really what people want to do. They want, you know, we all want to help people who are suffering.
I want to get everybody else's take on that too, but the only thing I'd say is that I really don't agree with that, because I don't think most wars are caused over humanitarian reasons. I think they're caused over money.
Well,
Afghanistan
wasn't. They're not. We're not fighting in Afghanistan for the resources.
No, but we're definitely not. We didn't go there for humanitarian reasons either. That's a joke too.
I believe we went there because they attacked towers. Okay, and the people responsible there. That's
right.
The main reason for
being.
The money is kind of a side thing. It's going to happen very war, okay? But the main reason why it's being.
Rumsfeld said there are no good targets in Afghanistan?
Well, yeah, he's probably playing mountains and stuff, so it's going to be tough for him.
when he said there were no good targets in Afghanistan, he was saying there's nothing we want there.
Okay. Well, whatever. I'm sure it's tougher because the guys are hiding in the mountains and stuff, but they bombed them pretty good at first. But as far as saying the military-industrial complex has failed, do you mean like the guys bring them home, or are you trying to say that whole
thing's
going to fall apart?
I mean, the whole thing, bringing all the soldiers home and them having no jobs to come to, therefore having to add that to unemployment, and on top of that having to lay off everybody in any industry that has anything to do with the military-industrial complex, bomb-making, bullet-making, armor-making, tank-making, plane-making, you name it.
Yeah.
Well, they're not going to go away.
Well, you might have a point. In fact, remember that it was World War II that pulled us out of the Depression.
Partially.
Well, that's a matter of debate.
Excuse me,
we'll get back right with you, folks. I just want to announce line 5, 816 area code. You're now, the line is open. You're welcome to speak up. You're speaking to Melissa Roddy. She's a film documentarian with her latest film. Has it coming up? It's just segments of it have appeared at YouTube, and it's what is it? Conflict of Interest? What?
Yeah,
Melissa?
And the subtitle is Patterns in Chaos. When you search for it on YouTube, you need the subtitle Patterns in Chaos because there's
Patterns
a lot of things on YouTube called Conflict of Interest.
Okay, all right. 816 area code, the line is open. You're free to speak up one at a time. And I'm not so sure World War II brought us out of the Depression. And I know this, that I think that the military-industrial, bringing all these people home and shutting down the missile factories, I don't think is going to do anything but put more people out in the street to change some history, local history here in America. Nothing wrong. What would be wrong? The unions would grow. People would be unemployed.
There's a peacetime army, too. Just because they're at war doesn't mean all of a sudden they're going to all be unemployed.
George Washington really loved the standing army, didn't he?
I know what he said about standing army, okay, but this isn't 1776 either. It's a whole different situation. Now, Eisenhower said that one had the same warning, but he said we need to stand the army now too. He warned the first guy to warn about military. If they're feeling military right now, they all have contracts. Until that contract expires, they're in. Simple as that. They're paid unless they do something,
Well, what I was trying to say earlier was that there is some contraction going on in military contracts. They're asking for less money. They're closing operations. They're volunteering to close operations.
What do you mean, like military operations?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what that guy was saying to me about the subcommittee hearing, was that the military is asking for less money, and the representatives are not trying to get the money to create, pork projects in their districts. That it's like a whole new day. Everybody's looking at it differently.
They're not trying to get money for pork projects?
Exactly.
I don't buy that. Each one of these senators has got something going that'll help out, bring jobs, whatever you want to call a pork project to their district. I mean,
they're not necessarily looking to the military for that, for those projects.
Well, no,
they could be all kinds of things.
I mean, as far as the thing being too big to fail, I think there's no business too big to fail. But like I say, if they bring them home, they might have early retirement. But until these guys' contracts are filled, they're gonna have a job. And they can always, re-sign up. So I'm not worried about these guys in the military not having jobs. Actually, a lot of people join the military right now. They have record highs because they need jobs. And they're not going to go away. So I'm not worried about those guys. And like I say, if we leave, a peacetime war is not a bad thing also. And think about Switzerland, right? Almost a lot of those countries have some sort of standard draft where they have to do a certain amount of service, civil service, something. I think Germany does. They all do. They're required to. So they have something. May not like our thing, but, I mean, they have some requirement what they have to fill. Everybody does. Unless it's probably an exceptional case. But
And it's interesting to note that Germany and France who declined to go to Iraq are still there with us in Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, did both of them really not go to Iraq? Because I thought Germany went to Iraq.
No, Germany did not go to Iraq.
Well,
and we all know about France and the Freedom Prize.
They had probably some sort of NATO obligation. Or Merkel probably signed on to something. You know, I think she committed some troops to Afghanistan. There's a reason they're there. They're not that many. It's not like they're there.
Pump it up a little bit.
Although,
they're not as big as the United States, right?
They're not as big. But, yeah, they're not as big as all. Not as close. They weren't as much soldiers. But still, I mean, compared to we have a whole lot more guys there.
And
girls, too, by the way. Let's be correct. They're both there.
I don't know about Rabel, but for me personally, I just wanted to say that you guys are talking about compulsory national service. I'm totally against that.
No, I'm not. I'm not. Being like Obama's civilian defense force thing going there. No. I don't think that you should be required to do, not in our country, required to do civil service.
Well, it's like I said.
Required to volunteering. That'd be great. Or maybe you'd go in something. You'd sign up and then you have to do some public service afterwards, not military stuff.
In a lot of these countries, it doesn't have to be military service. It can be humanitarian service. So you have a choice.
Yeah,
you have 2 years of service.
Yeah, but it's required, though. It's required. We're here to hear
about
required.
I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing.
Okay.
I'm against any compulsory government.
Are you against compulsory education?
I didn't hear you.
Are you against compulsory education? Because we have that to the age of 18 in this country.
I'm not against education, but I'm against any compulsory government, period. You can get education compulsory from your parents. You don't need to get it from government necessarily. Although I do agree that there are social aspects that are needed to go. You should send your children to public school, at least at certain ages. The teenage years are formative, especially be important for social interaction. But I'm not against school. I'm not against any public social thing, but I have a problem with being compelled by law to do things that are against my will.
Gotcha.
Well, if it's a law, you kind of got to do it, you know. Speed limit, you got to go speed limit. You don't got to go, you know. Of course, you pay tickets. If you park somewhere, if it's a law that you park, say you don't have to do it, but you know you can go to jail, talk to the judge. You don't got to do anything really. You pay the fine.
Well,
you
can get
practice. You go to jail.
My experience is I try not to break any law that I agree with.
Okay.
Not agree with. So the stuff you disagree with is just longer. I'll carry on.
Well, that's fine. That's
kind of funny the way almost. I'm going to say to the cop, you know what? I didn't agree the speed limit was 70. I always thought it was 90. It should always be 90, you know? Ever since I've lived here, you're wrong.
So how's it going?
You talking to me?
Yeah. How you doing, Melissa? Do you feel overwhelmed by these all these anti-warriors out on the line?
I expect them.
Ah.
I feel the reason I came out, I've gone public before my film is done is because I know that there are a lot of that the anti-war movement is building, and I see the danger, and the Afghan community in this country that I talk to and in Australia and in Afghanistan and Europe, they are panicked. The sound of the peace movement is really panicking them. They're terrified because they know that they could see another million Afghans die as a result of this.
Let me say one more thing. I'll let you guys have the horn. Excuse me. I'll let you have the horn in just a minute, gentlemen. The people, you ought to be worried. The Afghan people in America should be worried, not about themselves in America, but more, I think America's learning its lessons quickly, about stupid wars in stupid places and where over stupid issues, especially when it comes to the ruling class's issues. But I separate myself from that class of people, and I'm not going to get involved with it except to watch it from a distance. I haven't had the freedom to travel to Afghanistan back and forth. I ran into some people from Iran, young men, who died fighting the Shah in the late 70s. And that was clearly an intrigue made by our government overthrowing a democratically elected president of Iran in 1956 or something like that, President Mossadegh. And because I'm familiar with the intrigue of the ruling class and how it manipulates us and the poor Afghan people who have been in this horrible conflict between the Soviet Chinese or the Russian Chinese and even the British in the 1800s and us. So Afghanistan has a tortured history of imperialist intrigue. And I feel bad and terrible about it. We should never have went in the first place. Hunting down Osama bin Laden was a law enforcement problem. That was a job for Interpol, and if anything, the CIA had, it was a law enforcement problem. It was never a military problem.
Interpol's not going to go into Afghanistan. I'll let you go because I don't want to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
Let me finish. Okay. This is not the problem. Is not going to go away until we end it. We, the people who are sponsoring the imperialist ruling class in the United States, until we stop doing that. You know, I don't know the answers to these situations, but I tell you once again, and I know you're going to say, well, Mike, that's just you're an old man and you're remembering the Vietnam days, but I'm telling you, I see the helicopters leaving the embassy in Kabul. I see the helicopters leaving the embassy in Kabul. I see it happening just as surely as I saw them leave the helicopters in Saigon in 1974, 75. I see us jumping and running. The people, listen, sister, Glenn Beck, the new white Jesus, of the American right wing, is even talking about getting out of Afghanistan. He's not talking about getting out of Iraq. He's talking about getting out of Afghanistan. When Glenn Beck, the new white Jesus, who bombs these people out here in Kansas with propaganda salvos on the AM radio, all these guys out here go to work and listen to Glenn Beck in the morning, and he's talking about getting out. When he's talking about getting out, sister, there's going to be a problem, okay? I don't know what to tell you, sister, but I think we better look at the UN.
I think that the out of Afghanistan message is the propaganda. It's Pakistani propaganda, it's CIA propaganda. Because CIA wants to continue doing the drug business with ISI without having to trip over G.I. Joe. And they can't do that as long as G.I. Joe is there, and the more G.I. Joes that are there, the more inconvenient it is for the CIA. And they are the ones feeding the peace movement. And they know what buttons to push on y'all. On me too. You know, I mean, if I didn't know as much as I know, I would probably be in there, you know, yelling troops out as well. But I know what will happen if we leave before the Afghan people have regained their strength. We will be leaving a devastated people to a devastating situation.
I agree with you.
I don't think that we can do that honorably. I think that, you know, the strong, the reason I'm a liberal is because I think the strong have a duty to help the vulnerable. And so, in spite of the fact that we're in a bad economic situation in this country, we are still a zillion times stronger than the Afghans. And we have to stop funding Pakistan, and we have to get the CIA to stop putting money in Hekmatyar's pocket, and we have to have enough troops on the ground to make the place secure so those people can rebuild and then take care of themselves. They can defend themselves, because their problem with Pakistan is not going to go away. But we shouldn't go away until they're strong enough to defend themselves.
Yeah. See, I agree. That's what the general's saying, I think. He's saying, or very similar. I mean, you know, Interpol's not going to go after Obama. We have a legitimate right there to be there, in my opinion, because it put people who claim responsibility for the 9/11, okay, are these terrorist guys, okay? They live there. They're boasting about it. They make movies about it, saying how great they are and how they're going to tear us apart. They live there. So our military has a legitimate reason to go, more than Iraq, to go on in and take these be responsible. Not for responsibility for the people, to be responsible for people in the United States. Okay, we're attacked. They are responsible to go out there and take these guys out. And I believe, like you do, we should have to go, and we should have to go there, put some stability, put some
general
want. Huh? I think we should. I agree with you. We should go. We should withdraw. That we see, like the guy said, these helicopters taking off. What Obama's proposing is horrific. I think. I mean, if he's going to do what he's going to do, we should go. I mean, this general's a general for a reason, and he knows what he's doing. I mean, he's not going to try to. I mean, it's like this, okay? I mean, he's a specialist. He's done this most of his life. He knows what he's doing. He knows he's doing more than Biden knows. He knows we're doing more closely, in this situation. He knows my problem more than I do, because that's what he does for a living. Now, if you had another person, like another expert, let's say, say what's pig surgeon, right? You want them for shoulder. Not a neurosurgeon. They're both experts, but you want the right type of person. That's what I mean. The right type of person for a situation. I think Obama's made the same mistake that Bush made at the same time. Because when the Iraq thing was still going on at first, the generals he listened to the generals, okay? He didn't give the generals what they wanted. Remember all the stories where families would be mailing their GI sons and daughters body armor and stuff because the army didn't get it to them? They didn't have the right jeeps and stuff? Because Bush went political. Obama's doing the same thing. And our guys will be sitting there. The same thing will happen. And then, like you say, probably maybe in 4 years, whenever Obama's term is up, he'll do the same thing Bush did, put more troops in there. I don't know. But I think it's a big mistake not listening to this general, not doing what he says.
Right. But Bush never listened to the generals.
At the end, okay, they asked for more troops, and he gave them what they wanted. He gave them a surge thing. He gave them the surge, and they gave him more troops, and he gave them what they wanted. Toward the end.
He gave them surge to Iraq.
Yeah, in Iraq. At the beginning, Bush didn't listen, but toward the end, the generals asked for certain types of troops, then they went to the Congress and they kind of got the troops they wanted at the end when it was way too late. I think if they got a listen, general, we'd probably been out of Iraq a long time ago. But yeah, I mean, he never listened. Obama's doing the same thing. He's listening to politicians. He's listening to his buddies in Chicago, but he's not listening to the general. There are military speakers I hear that are speaking up say, listen to the general. It's what he does. He's an expert. Yeah. I mean, Obama doesn't know what he's doing. He's not a military. Biden doesn't know. Pelosi sure doesn't know.
Right.
I mean, I'm hearing Hillary saying, go listen to the general, I mean.
Well, and also, if you were to look at General McChrystal's new guidelines for troops in the field, they are extremely civilian friendly. He is saying if you have the enemy in your sights, if the Taliban is right there in front of you, but there is a risk that you will hit a civilian in your efforts to get at the enemy, let the enemy go. The civilian safety is more important. That is McChrystal's new guidelines.
Well, like I say, I'd go with the general, his advice. I mean,
I think it's important too that we remember like why we go to war with countries. Like, if we're going for humanitarian reasons, it's very different than if we're going when a country attacked us or on that pretext. Because if you go for humanitarian reasons, it's understood that you're going to nation build, and that's why mostly I'm against humanitarian reasons unless we want to make our military voluntary for every conflict. Like each guy gets to, or woman gets to decide, hey, I want to volunteer for this conflict, as opposed to I want to volunteer for the army and then get sent to war for something they might not agree with.
But everybody that's in the army now, volunteered after 9/11.
Yep.
They volunteered with the idea they were going to Afghanistan.
Right, I agree with you, and that's wrong that they went to Iraq, and that's why I said they should. If you're going to do humanitarian wars, you have to do them so that they're voluntary in nature completely. But
if you join the army,
Let me get to my point there, because it's only 5 seconds. The only thing I want to say is that we didn't go to Afghanistan for humanitarian reasons, although it does overlap now because of how long it's gone on and all that. But unfortunately, when you go to war for non-humanitarian reasons, when you go for self-defense, you go in to do one thing, destroy the enemy's ability to make war. And that's why I kind of agree, in a sense, with what the host, I think, or the guy that was talking before that let us go ahead and talk now, he said that it was kind of a police affair. Well, in a way, it is a police affair because, you know, after we dethroned the Taliban, that should have been it. We should have just left. There's no, we rebuild you and all this stuff. No, you picked your government, supposedly, under, you know, maybe they didn't, but whatever. They got a government. We overthrew it because it attacked us or whatever. That's how it's supposed to work.
You know, but the Taliban, okay, so the Taliban facilitated the development of Al-Qaeda, right? They gave them safe harbor and worked closely with them. And they still work closely with them in Pakistan. But Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are allies in Pakistan, and they are allies in fighting the Americans and NATO in Afghanistan. So they're still there. And there is still a very good reason for our own safety why we need to make sure that the Taliban doesn't come back into power in Afghanistan. And the only way to do that is to stop funding Pakistan and to fund Afghanistan's reconstruction and to give them defense, to give them protection while they're doing it.
I don't disagree with you now. I'm just saying in the beginning it'd be nice if our motive stayed true to the cause, which would be Taliban supports Al-Qaeda, we dethrone Taliban, we leave. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because then you police the Al-Qaeda problem.
The Bush administration strangely let them go.
Right.
And I think it's because they have the Bush family has financial interests in Pakistan. I think they're letting Pakistan control. They're letting Pakistan call the shots still, just like they were back in the 80s. But I told the story of Joanne Herring and her two-hour meeting with George Bush. And after that two-hour meeting with George Bush, her lifelong pal James Baker comes up to her and says, "We're going to give him a lot of good stuff." Right? And I found this article about oil and gas, about this oil company in Pakistan, and where I found this article was in Charlie Wilson's archives. And when I found it, suddenly a light bulb went off in my head. You see, back in 1981, at the beginning, Congress already knew that the guys that the CIA was letting Pakistan support, that the guys who were getting the most of our funding were doing a terrible job and killing more Afghans than Soviets. Mm-hmm. Congress already knew that as early as 1981. And I had a Republican senator, Senator Gordon Humphrey, who was a huge fan of Ronald Reagan, say to me that he and other members of Congress were lobbying, importuning the Reagan administration to change the program of letting Pakistan control the show. But they just seemed to get through to the Reagan administration and the CIA. They kept saying, oh, plausible deniability, we can't let the Soviets know that we're doing it. But everybody knew that we were doing it. I mean, we were sitting down at the table with Pakistan and the Soviets in Afghanistan at the UN. There were four-way talks. Everybody knew we were doing that. So this whole plausible deniability thing was just silly, and that's the word that Senator Humphrey used. So when I found this article about oil in Pakistan, Union Texas Petroleum in Pakistan, suddenly the light bulb went off in my head. It said, ah, that's the reason Senator Humphrey and these other members of Congress couldn't get through to the administration, the Reagan administration. I will bet you donuts that all of those people that Joanne Herring told me who were her close friends, George Bush, James Baker, Charlie Wilson, I'll bet they all had an interest in Union Texas Petroleum. And sure enough, I've proven that Charlie Wilson did, and Baker Botts was the primary law firm for Union Texas. I haven't got any proof on the Bush family yet, but I'm pretty sure that I'm right, and that's what was influencing policy decisions by W in this decade.
It sounds like a plausible theory, but just from the things that I've read, I read a book a while ago, I don't remember the exact title, but it was something about foreign intervention from Hawaii all the way to Iraq. And it was it basically laid out that, like, it's a three-step process usually when we go to an undeclared war. It's a corporation complains about their treatment in a foreign country, either through taxation or socialization or, you know, nationalization of the industry. So then they complain to Congress. Then Congress gets together and decides it's a threat to the national security, quote-unquote. And then the third step is we go in. And the last step, which is kind of a phantom step, is that we then tell the people after they've realized they've been swindled that, we went in there to liberate these people. And that's usually
happened in Iraq, but that's not what happened in Afghanistan, and we had to declare war in Afghanistan.
Hold that thought for a minute.
Okay.
Hold that thought, Melissa, and folks, I want you to know, line 5, the switchboard is full. 636, area code 636, line 5, you're on air. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas. And Melissa, I want to tell you something. I had half a dozen guests listening to this show in the garage over the speakers on a separate computer, and they were so angry with even having to think about this issue. They stayed for an hour and a half. Half of them have left, and the other half have their rapt attention on the speakers in the garage.
I'm flattered.
Thinking about this,
I'm honored by the
people are really just. This is really a rare time when the switchboard is full. The garage is people coming in and out of my driveway, coming into the garage to listen to the show on the speakers in the garage. So you have really had – you're having audience. Again, this is Melissa Roddy with give us your contact information again, Melissa. I'm sorry. It's Conflict of Interest, Patterns of Chaos.
And it's in three parts on YouTube. Please watch all three parts. Because they, you know, there's setups in part one that are paid off in part three. And that's why I keep going back, in my conversation to 1981 and to 1978. Because these seeds that were sown back in the 70s and early 80s were still in play under the Bush administration. And that's why Obama and Richard Holbrooke were calling the previous policy in the region incoherent. And Obama is saying, this is not year 8, this is year 1, because he's looking at the situation and saying, okay, this was done really horribly, and we need to do this right. We can't just bugger out of there and leave those people defenseless. And so my project is called Conflict of Interest, and the subtitle is Patterns in Chaos. If you want to look for it in YouTube, you should use both the title and the subtitle. I also have a blog, afghan-info.blogspot.com.
Yeah, I just want to say I still find it disturbing that people are distinguishing war under Obama from war under Bush as if they're two completely different things. War is always has been and always will be an imperialist battle fought by one rich empire against another for control of the poor of the world, period. And if Obama is the agent of change, and if we are talking in the intellectual discourse that we've had for the last nearly 2 hours now, why is it that we're still rationalizing, or that some are still, Melissa, why are you still rationalizing the use of military and war as the only option for this region? And seeming to give acceptance.
I'm not saying it's the only option. I'm saying it's a necessary component.
I don't think she's saying everything. I think she's saying you got to do military, but you also have to protect the people too. And I think the diplomacy is a big part of it too. But you have to, I don't think it's military action, because what she's setting up is different. She's saying you also have to take care of the civilian population too. Now, that's not military action. It's kind of protecting the people away.
There's absolutely nothing concerning the civilian population about bombings. There's absolutely nothing concerning the civilian population about propping up warlords, period.
McChrystal is saying we need to make this a ground war, not an aerial war.
It's still a war.
He's right. But that's because they have an enemy. There is a force.
They've created an enemy. They created the enemy.
You didn't
the
hear
enemy
me when I talked about how Pakistan created the Taliban in the 1990s.
With the CIA. with the CIA. Let's not forget that the funding was from the CIA and the purposes were from the CIA.
When they originally went in against the Russians, the CIA funded the Taliban to help fight like a future war. Again,
not just
but
funded,
that was way
created.
Back then. It doesn't do now.
It absolutely has something to do with now. Just because Americans forget history doesn't mean the rest of the world does. It absolutely has something to do. It absolutely has to do with
it. They funded them starting out. They're like this rogue gang, basically. And they funded them because they need someone to fight their war for them.
Without
getting a strong conflict. So they did. Now,
they're not rogue.
Fight.
You have to understand.
That's not now. That was like 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when the Russians were doing something. Now we're talking about the situation.
But we're still being shot with the Kalashnikovs that we bought them. You know what I mean? So yeah, his point's relevant.
Let's try to keep the walking stick passing around now and let Melissa talk if she wants to say something. It's okay. It's okay, brother. Let Melissa have the walking stick first because we're all putting her on the skewer at the campfire here. Now, Melissa, you got a chance to rebut with anybody, any of the brothers. Feel free.
All right, guys.
I know the people at one thing. People in the garage are laughing. Not about the subject, but because of the way that one guy said, is this like CB radios where you got to quit walking on each other? One guy asked. So let's keep that in mind, brother.
Thank you for moderating, Michael.
And try to keep it one at a time and always hand the stick back to Melissa. Okay,
thank
Melissa.
You're partly right, guys. The CIA was very much involved with providing weapons and some money through Pakistani ISI to those rebels in the 70s. They started in 78, I believe. Now, Pakistan started recruiting those rebels in 72, and they were never rogue. They were always under Pakistani, guidance. They were being trained and funded by Pakistan and supplied by Pakistan. And the U.S. was giving assistance to Pakistan for that program. Now, because Pakistan was doing it because the president of Afghanistan was saying, we want to renegotiate the border. We don't think that border is accurate. We don't recognize it. And that's why Pakistan started causing trouble in Afghanistan back in the 70s. Because Pakistan knew it was a confederation of ethnic regions that didn't want to be dominated by the Punjabis, and that some of those ethnic groups had cousins and brothers in Afghanistan, and that whole region west of the Indus River used to be part of Afghanistan. So Pakistan thinks, and quite logically, although it's not a, I mean, it's there. The logic is rational, but the response is still horrible. But it thinks rationally that Afghanistan wants half of its territory. And it's going to keep fighting Afghanistan and keeping it unstable for as long as it can get away with it. And so far they've been getting away with it because they're controlling the discourse in this country.
Now, this is a geographical question. The British Empire settled,
yeah.
I don't know, I can't remember the name, the Durand Line, is this what you're talking, this is an artificial boundary imposed between Afghanistan and Afghanistan, am I correct?
Yes, in 1893, Sir Mortimer Durand just drew a line on a map. It has no logic in geography. You know, it's not a river, it doesn't go around mountains. Sometimes it goes through mountains that are 20,000 feet high, and the British took the high ground. And it runs right through properties, through the middle of town. One guy said there are places along the border where you can eat lunch in Pakistan and then go to the loo in Afghanistan.
Now, this was an imposed border boundary by the British Empire in the last part of the 1800s, and it was when the British were intent on occupying what countries or all the above? What was
the British occupied India at that point? So all of that region, all of it was British India.
Mm-hmm.
And previously, Afghanistan had gone all the way to the Indus River, and that Indus River had been the border between Afghanistan and India. The British wanted to go all the way to the border of Russia. You know, they wanted to keep going, right?
they were trying to conquer Afghanistan, and the Afghans were saying, no, you didn't. And we have stories like Gunga Din and, you know, or the slaughter.
The man who would be king. Rudyard Kipling.
All of these Kipling stories are about that conflict, about the British trying to conquer Afghanistan.
And they didn't failed.
Succeed, but they did manage to cut it in half.
Yes.
And so when the British left India in 1947, they created Pakistan as a way of maintaining their influence in the region. And they trained, and they set up the Pakistani government, the whole bureaucracy and the military. They trained the Pakistani military. So, in 1947, the Afghans started saying, whoa, hey, okay, now that you're leaving Britain, we want that other half of our country back. We want our access to the ocean again. They used to have a coast.
I didn't know that. And this is when the rise that Gould and Fitzgerald write about in their book of the Red Prince. The Red Prince. Didn't he come along sometime in the latter half of the 20th century? The so-called, or possibly maybe, the progressive Islamists. The Islam with the progressive faith, the Islam who were more of a Sunni persuasion, who came forward and wanted rights for women, who said that women should have the vote in 1921, before the women had the right to vote in the United States, from the top down, a war, I don't know what you call it. Who was this guy?
He was the king.
The king gave the women the right to vote before the women had the right to vote in the United States. Am I correct?
Yes. Yes, very true. Now, there was still veiling, and there was still a lot more conservative.
They had a right to vote.
Yeah.
They had a right to vote and a right to an education, didn't they?
What happened? Yeah. What happened since these changed so much?
Well, you got 14 minutes, Melissa. Good luck.
Okay.
Take it over.
What happened was, Pakistan recruited fundamentalists and that's who they had the CIA giving weapons and money to in the 70s. Now, in the 70s, in the 60s, the queen took off her veil, so the monarchy was saying women should be unveiled, women should go to college, women should have jobs and careers, and this was progressing more and more in the 70s, and they were advancing faster. And then they had a communist coup in the late 70s. But still, the communists were progressing, helping women progress in the country and helping to build industries and such and increase education across the countryside. But the United States helped Pakistan fund and train the fundamentalists. We built that fundamentalist that force. We lit that fundamentalist fire. And we set it, you know, spreading across Afghanistan. So that's our own fault. But it's a problem, but that problem isn't just the Afghans' problem. It's our problem, too. And it was stupid. And, people need to be, protesting Zbigniew Brzezinski in the streets. And Charlie Wilson, who goes around beating his chest like he's the great hero of Afghanistan. I had an Afghan gentleman that I know here in Los Angeles. He got to go to a studio screening of Charlie Wilson's War before it opened, and the producers ran up to him after the movie and said, what'd you think? And he said, that asshole destroyed my country. So we are very responsible for the destruction of Afghanistan.
I didn't know that. That's a wealth of information that I didn't know. But it makes perfect sense, too, you know? You had these conservative, crazy terrorists, they weren't terrorists, and we funded them, basically gave them power, a lot of money, too. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. But I see why we've done that, too. We wanted to fund this, like, rebel group to a point, or, this group, so they could, be like a guerrilla army for us. We would have to go into fight the Russians, which Price was passed up on. But, thanks. That's a wealth of information. I mean, I really appreciate that. I mean, that's amazing. It makes perfect sense now, too. So, we kind of created our own problem.
We did create our own problem, but we created a problem for the Afghans, too.
all the problems, the lifetime, generations of misery, blood, intertribal feuds, rivalry, bribery, corruption. This goes back from a long, long time. And this is one of the reasons I am so happy that every line of our switchboard is still. People are listening in right now. Every line, five lines are open. Half a dozen are in the garage. People are listening. Melissa, you have to close. Melissa, Roddy, give us your contact information once again and give us a closing statement.
Please, please go to my blog, www.afghan-info.blogspot.com. That's afghan-info.blogspot.com. Write to me there. Please become one of my friends on my blog, or look up the three parts of conflict of interest, patterns and chaos on YouTube, and write to me on YouTube. I would be happy to answer questions, on the blogs on YouTube or on my blog. And I just wanted to say one other thing. Not only did we fund the fundamentalists through the ISI, but it's important to know that everybody knows this was a proxy war against the Soviets, but there were Afghan moderates, nationalists, who were starved for supplies during that period. And Pakistan intentionally created this seven-headed hydra that was the Afghan resistance, so that those people would go after each other and create civil war in Afghanistan after the Soviets left. And if we leave before the Afghans are strong enough to defend themselves, they will have the same problem over again. Up to 1.5 million people died in Afghanistan in the 1990s before we overthrew the Taliban. And those numbers will be repeated again if we leave too soon. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Melissa Roddy.
You know what's funny, Michael?
Yeah.
Well, all those things that we were naming off as being disastrous and being horrible, because they are, business interests see those things as opportunities.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to note who sits on the cabinet of the current regime leader. Big business.
Hi, Michael.
Goodbye. Right on, brother. What a great evening on Radio Free Kansas. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. What a great
Radio Free Kansas. God damn it, this big stuff. Still listening?
Yes, sir.
Tell us about our brother, Mike Cannon. What happened to the brother? I heard his house is raided. Probably he had to. He's probably deaf from the acoustic bombs in Pittsburgh. Raided his house.
No, I don't think he got any of those sound bombs hitting him. I did in my right ear. I'm still deaf in my right ear from it.
Tell us what's going on with Mike Cannon. I mean, he's part of this Elliot Madsen nasty affair in New York City, I guess.
I don't really want to talk too much about it right yet. It's just because it's still in litigations. I think it would be probably bad for us to speak on anything right now.
Okay.
But I'll just tell people that I think his spirits are good. I think that everybody should know by now that the state is a fascist criminal state. And will do whatever it can to maintain its measly amount of power. It's a very fragile power system, so it uses massive amounts of violent control instead of power because it can't lead, so at least it can control. And
well, it certainly is. That's a true voice coming from the resistance. I'll tell you that, listeners.
And I'll tell you another thing. For anybody who wants to marginalize anarchists and anarchist thought and anarchist action, ask yourself this: why does the FBI and Homeland Security and police forces and National Guard crack down so violently and repressively against anarchists every time there's some sort of a political spectacle, yet they don't crack down on right-wing extremists and they don't crack down on these idealistic hippies in the same violent fashion?
Well, what about the known associates of Scott Roeder, who killed Dr. Tiller?
The ones that sit in office? Those ones you're talking about?
The ones that are in office, the ones that sit outside the clinics and spit on the women going in. They just let these people walk with a free ticket, buddy. I'm telling you. Free in Kansas, it's a free ticket on anybody wanting to enforce the Christian theocratic state upon down the throats of the people, the non-believers, the people. Never mind this. The point is the reason I think this is a voice of a real resistance in the United States, a resistance that is not into domestic terrorism, and a resistance into mobilizing the people in a real way for participating in a democratic spirit. And I think that's what makes it so dangerous. And I've got 2 minutes, and what a great evening, huh?
Oh, yeah. It's great. I wasn't expecting to hear half of that conversation that we heard tonight on this show.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. We're now uploading onto radioforall.net and to store our stuff. Say they sweep me up and take my Twitter box away, like they did Mike Cannon. I'm putting it all up on the Internet Archive. There'll be over 200 shows of Radio Free Kansas, the good, the bad, and the ugly, at Internet Archive. It'll be going up week after week. Check in. There'll be over 200 shows there, folks, in a matter of a few months. And I want to thank all of you for calling in and participating with Melissa in this conversation. I don't agree with her, but she certainly
has educated herself and us with things about Afghanistan. I want to thank you. Thank you, Rabble Rouser. And 816, you're awfully quiet tonight. That's okay, brother. But I'm glad you're listening in. I want to close now. My name is Mike Cadell with Radio Free Kansas. What a wonderful evening. I'm so happy. Look forward to next Friday free-for-all. We'll have another special guest coming on. Also, by the way, I've been receiving some interesting requests for interviews. I'll release them off the blog. Just go to the Vulgar and Profound fightandcockflyer.blogspot. Just Google. You know how to Google. Fightandcockflyer, and you'll check the daily news ticker out. There'll be announcements of upcoming important interviews, and I hope to see you then. Enjoy your weekend. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas. Give me a call sometime. Check in regularly. Thank you so much for listening. Good night.